Hello and welcome into the season opening edition of the Golf Channel podcast with Rex and Lav. It is certainly great to be back in the lab. We've got some news to get to, some predictions that are sure to go awry. Rex, are you ready for another year covering this great game?
I am ready for another year. We talk about this all the time. I think scarcity had become the keyword last year. That should go in the golf dictionary forever because Brian Rolapp put that out there, what he wants to see of the schedule going forward. In the last few weeks, sitting alone at home, not having anywhere to let loose my takes, I can only imagine you're just ready to uncork so many hot takes because you've been just walking around your house. I'm sure your kids are tired of hearing what your hot take is on Brooks or Live Golf or what the schedule would look like. So, yes, I'm excited to be back.
We almost did an emergency podcast because, as you mentioned, Brooks Koepka had like the latest drop that you could possibly imagine. December 23rd, Christmas Eve. This harkened back to the Tiger Woods injury news days when he would just drop it at 5 o'clock on Friday and expect everyone to drop everything and scramble. But while you were away, if you somehow missed this, Brooks Koepka announced in a mutual decision that he is leaving LIV Golf with a year left on his contract. There's a lot of repercussions, obviously, for LIV and the league that he is leaving, but also potentially for the PGA Tour. So I think it's probably best, Rex, and most instructive to break this up into parts. Let's start with the LIV Golf angle. What is the significance of Brooks Koepka leaving LIV? And again, he was one of the big coups back in 2022.
This is free agency. This is what Greg Norman wanted. So here it is. Here's your free agency. You guys were on the right end of this early because you had the big paychecks and LIV Golf was paying all of these exorbitant guaranteed fees to players and you were able to pull them back. I can't say twofold. You're absolutely right. To drop this on the 23rd, that's just mind-boggling.
Outrageous.
You're just trying to hide this and no one's going to fall for it. However, you and I both know if you go back to that very first year that Brooks Koepka joined LIV Golf, he was one of the very first players, at least I heard of, rumblings that maybe there was some buyer's remorse, maybe that he was ready to come back. Maybe this isn't exactly what he signed up for. We have seen it from a number of players that now they've gone to 72 holes, but the first couple of years of 54 holes, playing team golf in shorts with loud music really isn't your thing, that you kind of need to be locked in. You need to go to the majors. We knew this about Brooks. You're talking about a guy that didn't particularly want to play regular tour events, that he could only get locked in for major championships. How did you think he was going to take to this new form of team golf and everything's relaxed and everything's a big party? So you can't be surprised that Brooks is the first one back. I think twofold when it comes to LIV Golf, we have seen time and time again, since John Rahm, I would make the argument that they have not had a quote unquote big splash signing. Yeah, you can go back and we can nitpick a little bit about what we consider a big splash signing, but John Rahm was really the last one. And I think losing one of those big high-profile players opens the door for others. And I think that's what we're going to see going forward. Brooks was always going to leave LIV Golf. He was always going to want to come back to the PGA Tour. That's a whole different conversation. But what this does is create essentially a year for the likes of Bryson DeChambeau to sit and watch. How does this play out? What does the pathway back to the PGA Tour look like? Can I still remain competitive? Can I remain relevant? And can I do what I need to do to get ready for the major championships? I think it's going to be telling for those players more so than Brooks.
Yeah, I think as it relates to LIV, I don't believe that this is a death knell. Does it sting? No. For sure. Right? And Brooks Koepka was the second most accomplished player on the LIV roster behind only Phil Mickelson. I thought it was a huge coup to get a player who was really, you know, the primetime player, the big game hunter, the major championships over the previous half decade. Does it signal somehow that this is the beginning of the end for LIV Golf? I think it's really too early to say that. But Brooks Koepka, I sort of look at him in a singular way, where Brooks never really bought in as a team owner. He was never donning the Smash GC gear. He always was wearing the Nike stuff. He didn't fly the flag for LIV. He was pretty outspoken and more honest than any other player about why he even made the jump to LIV back in 2022. It was basically injury related. Had a serious knee issue. Hip was bothering him. It essentially took the bag knowing that his career might be shortened. I don't think anyone faulted him for that potential excuse, but the ramifications were pretty significant for the PGA Tour losing a player of his ilk. To me, this move actually says more about Brooks than it says about either LIV or the PGA Tour. Here's a player who is 35 years old in Brooks Koepka. His game is falling off. No one talks about him or fears him anymore, at least the way that they did back in the sort of 27 through 2019 era. His reputation has taken a hit. And I think that's what Rory is talking about when he says that these players have paid their consequence. Yes, they got paid. They got paid very handsomely. But the PGA Tour players since 2022 and the advent of LIV, those players have been rewarded and compensated quite handsomely as well. I think Rory is talking reputationally as it relates to Brooks Koepka and the consequence. And now you sort of have to worry and concern yourself with what is the path potentially going to look like for these sort of players.
No, and I agree with you. I do not think this is a seminal moment for LIV Golf. I think that's coming up, though. I mean, we're talking about 12 months away from Bryson DeChambeau. Whether you're going to keep him or are you going to let him go, talking about LIV Golf. If you decide to cut ties with Bryson DeChambeau, he may not be the best player on your tour, but he is by far the most popular player in golf, at least one of your popular players. So that, to me, is going to be the pivotal moment for LIV Golf later this year. As I pointed out, I think all of us knew all along that Brooks was probably going to be the one that cracked the dam, that walked away first. The other part of the equation is going to be more fascinating to me as far as what does the pathway back look like. Brooks is unique. He essentially started his pro career playing in Europe. That pathway is wide open for him. I can imagine a scenario where the PGA Tour lays out some sort of fundamental penance, whatever that is. And I do find it interesting that Rory can talk about that he feels like they've paid the price enough. I don't know that other PGA Tour players would necessarily agree with him on that front. I think there does have to be some sort of whatever it is you want to call it. You have to serve 1 year suspension. I think Hudson Swafford, we've talked a lot about him in the past. I think he kind of sets the standard. They essentially said 2027 for him based on what he did that very first season with LIV Golf. It has less to do with 1 year from the date of your last tournament and more so of what did you do while you were still a member of the PGA Tour? So if 2027 is sort of the starting line for a Brooks Koepka, then I can imagine him having a full year of playing on the DP World Tour, playing in the major championships. TGL was sort of part of the conversation with Rory. I don't know why that couldn't be the crack in the door. Maybe that's the way players first walk back in because it's at least partially owned by the PGA Tour. They have a regulation right now. You have to be a tour member to be a member of TGL. It would be a good and clean way to bring these players back, at least reintroduce them to the ecosystem.
Yeah, that seems like the most obvious starting point because TGL is desperate to incorporate him. That would likely just involve a sign-off by Brian Rolapp to have him appear as a reserve in a couple of matches. I'm with you that the cleanest, easiest route would be for Brooks Koepka just to play a schedule on the DP World Tour in 2026. And if you think about it, he was already playing internationally almost exclusively on LIV anyway. And so he could handpick his schedule, maybe do back-to-backs to try and get his game as sharp as possible for the major championships with an eye on the PGA Tour in 2027 and beyond. The PGA Tour question, and you know, you hear from a lot of fans, just bring him back right away. And I hear that. I understand that. We had a roundtable last week with Rich Lerner on Golf Central where we were debating the pros and cons of that. And I think what's really interesting is that if you ask any PGA Tour player, he's going to have a different opinion, a different stance on what they should do in regards to Brooks Koepka. And I think in particular, what's regard to what's fair. I always go back to the data point from last year when the PGA Tour surveyed 50,000 fans and overwhelmingly 70% of those fans told the PGA Tour that they wanted the best players in the world to all be back together again. Reunification, the best players on the PGA Tour and the best players on LIV to be back together again. Brian Rolapp does not carry the same scars as his predecessor in this turf war. And so he is going to be looking at this with an entirely fresh perspective of can Brooks Koepka help my product and boost the product right now? Absolutely. Will it somehow trigger this massive rating surge and the interest in the PGA Tour is going to be higher than it's ever been? No, I don't believe that to be the case. But if you can reincorporate a five-time major champion who has been one of the biggest headliners in golf over the past decade, I think you are very eager to bring him back into the golf ecosystem. Whether that would actually fly with the membership in 2026, I'm pretty dubious on that.
We're not getting to fair. I love the fact you threw fair out there. And I know you and I as journalists, we always want to talk about what we think is fair and what isn't. That has so many definitions when it comes to if there's 280 tour players essentially that have PGA Tour cards, then there's going to be 280 versions of what fair is going to be. So I don't think we're ever going to land on anything that makes everybody happy. That the thing about Brian Rolapp is he has largely the support of the membership. You look at what he's doing with the schedule. It's been tepid support. Not everybody is on board with the idea of scarcity and a smaller schedule and a more top-heavy schedule. But I think having Tiger Woods leading that charge as the chairman of the Future Competitions Committee was a very savvy move. I think this could be another example of how, if this is what Brian Rolapp wants, if he decides that, yes, Brooks can come back starting in 2026, it could create an interesting scenario as well. Let's say Brooks comes back and has a full PGA Tour card, but you're not qualified for any of the signature events. Imagine what that could do for the open field events. I mean, it could be huge for the other events that don't have those marquee fields right now that we always point to when we say they don't get the best players anymore. So it does create an opportunity, but don't hit me with fair because we're never going to get to that.
Yeah, and look, it would be the PGA Tour policy board that is deciding what is fair and what the potential punishment would be, obviously, with Brian Rolapp having a significant say in that as well. The policy board is supposed to be a cross-section, right, of the PGA Tour membership. You're supposed to have the stars. You're supposed to have the rank-and-file members, and they're supposed to come to some sort of consensus. It's not like they're going to send out a secret ballot and be like, yes or no, Brooks Koepka should be back in 2026. It's going to be up to the policy board, future competition committee, and the like. So with Brooks Koepka out of the way, Rex, on LIV Golf, you sort of fast forward to 2026 and what the season could be. The players who would be tasked with replacing him. They're not going to replace Brooks Koepka's star power. The players who reportedly are making the jump, whether it's a Lawrie Kanner, Thomas Dietrich, Elvis Smyth, those are the players who have been reported as making the move. You're going to have three more players through the promotions event, which happened last week in Florida. What do you make of LIV being unable to sign some of that top-end talent? I know you had a report on Akshay Bhatia last week.
The offseason was non-existent the way it kind of has been the last few years. And this absolutely kills me because we've talked a lot about this on this podcast. I love the idea of the transaction. The one thing that interests me about LIV Golf was it's going to become more of a mainstream sport. You and I are going to spend the next few months talking about football transactions as we get to free agency for the NFL, even college football, let's be honest. Lord knows what kind of quarterback your University of Georgia Bulldogs are going to sign in the offseason. But that, to me, is what is going to be the most interesting going forward. And they've never been able to sort of lasso that. I do want to point out, we have such a huge lineup now on Monday, Tuesdays, and Wednesdays on Golf Channel. And one of the new shows is going to be Jimmy Roberts. And his focus is going to be on the business of golf. And this would be a perfect opportunity for Jimmy to dive into exactly what free agency in the offseason look like for LIV Golf. But you don't really have that. I think if you look
They haven't wanted to, Rex. They don't have transparent contracts. We don't know what the terms are. We don't know the money amount. We don't know the
years. It
seems
like such a missed opportunity. You're absolutely right. Because this is what's going to interest your average golf fan. If you can somehow bring mainstream sports into this, we're going to talk about in the NBA, the NFL, college football. All of the off seasons now are part of the storyline. It's part of the news. Some people say it's even better than the actual competition on the field. And in this particular instance, LIV Golf doesn't have any interest in doing the one thing that was going to separate them from the PGA Tour. If you look at, and I did break the Akshay Bhatia news, and I was fascinated by it because according to multiple sources, he was offered a quote-unquote lucrative contract to join LIV Golf. It makes sense. They're an international tour. He has a lot of international appeal. He's a young up-and-coming player. He's won on the PGA Tour. Lucrative offer, though, that's a sliding scale now because I don't think we're going to see those nine-figure offers like we saw with the likes of Brooks Koepka and John Rahm and Dustin Johnson on all of those early stars that made the jump over here. I think when you're talking about lucrative offers now, you're looking at something more in the eight-figure range, which is still an incredible amount of money, but you're going to have to bank on the idea that they're okay taking this money and whatever they can earn on the golf course, which is also a lot of money, but it's a lot more in line now than with what Akshay could actually make on the PGA Tour if he has a breakout season. Look what Scotty has done the last few years. If anybody could justify not jumping to LIV Golf, I'm not quite sure if Scotty got an offer, and if so, what in the world it possibly could have been. It's Scotty Scheffler because he has made nine figures over the last few years based on what he's been able to do on the golf course. But it's another offseason that I walked away just disappointed. Like, is Victor Perez or Laurie Kanter? Is that really going to be your high-profile signings? Because if so, that's not going to move the needle for many.
Yeah, I mean, I would just love these contracts to be made public. Like, I think about my Jags and what they could potentially be doing in the offseason. Yeah. All of that information is readily available. I can look and see that Brian Thomas is in the third year of his rookie contract, and you could potentially flip him for a second rounder and another piece. And like, it's fun to sort of play GM. And if they're building out these franchises and these franchise models and what it's supposed to look like over the next decade, having that sort of information, salary caps, roster limits, term sheets, like all of that is sort of imperative in understanding the team dynamic, which Liv, again, has doubled down over and over and over again. The sausage finger, the first sausage finger of 2026 is up. And so please, the floor is yours.
At the 15-minute mark, perfect timing for that. I do want to point out, and this was a release that came through last week, and there's a lot of releases that come from Liv Goff that you sort of just gloss over, but it was the Crushers signing all four players that they've had all along. Sounds pretty boring, sounds pretty mundane. I do think it's significant because they are the most successful team, both on the golf course and from a business perspective. They have a lot of sponsors. They have probably latched on to the idea of team golf better than any other team on Liv. That, to me, is part of the conversation. Even if they didn't pick up another player, even if they did stay with their four players, you're absolutely right. If there was the transparency that we see in other sports, it would be so much more compelling.
Yeah, I still think there are some systemic issues as it relates to Liv. Obviously, the official World Golf Ranking case is still hovering. Chairman Trevor Immelman came out the end of 2025 and said they're still reviewing it. You know, I think it's a matter of if, or it should be when, not if, that's actually going to be made the case. But you look at the PGA Tour players, you know, the Signature Event Series has afforded players to make a ton of money, and they're still playing when they want to do so. There's still a dedicated offseason if you do want to have it, just as the players on Live Golf have it. PGA Tour players have it pretty good right now. Kudos to Akshay Bhatia for sort of seeing the bigger landscape and making a decision that he felt was best for him. Shifting gears now to the PGA Tour, and Rex, we're actually coming on the air a week later than we traditionally would have. That was because we did not have Kapalua, the Plantation Course, the Century to kick off the 2026 PGA Tour season. Instead, PGA Tour season is starting this week with the Sony Open at Wailea. Did you miss Kapalua and the traditional start to the season?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think you and I both, I think most golf fans, at least the ones who really want to watch this year round, they love tuning in that first week of January and seeing those sweeping vistas and looking at the winds and looking at the views. And I will say, without Kapalua on the schedule, I have a sort of a weird curiosity of what the driving stats are going to look like at the end of the season. Because it's hard to say one event.
You're not getting the skewed 400-yard drives anymore?
Yeah, it's hard to say one event could skew an entire season, and I'm not putting too much stock in it, but it will be curious that if you get rid of Kapalua, which is by far the easiest driving course on the PGA Tour, I mean, how many 400-yard drives do we see year in and year out on that golf course? But if you get rid of it, I am curious to see what it's going to look like at the end of the year. I think, however, and I don't want to put too much into this, but it's probably a look at what we can possibly anticipate in 2027. I'm not saying that Kapalua has become scarcity, if I'm going to use that as a verb going forward. I mean, that's Brian Rolapp's idea of what he wants the schedule to look like, one of the three tenets that he told the Future Competitions Committee to sort of focus on. But you can imagine a scenario where both Kapalua and the Sony Open become part of that scenario, that they aren't one of those 20 or 25 events that make up the true highlighted reimagined PGA Tour schedule. And not because they're not good events. Like I said, I did miss Kapalua. I do think it's a really fun way to start the year. But if you're looking at it from a dollars and cents point of view, it's really expensive to pick up the PGA Tour and ship all those things over to Hawaii for 2 weeks and then bring it back to the West Coast. If you can save the money and decide to start, I don't know, somewhere on the West Coast, maybe you start in Phoenix. I actually heard when I did this story in December, talking with a lot of players at the Hero World Challenge, there was a move that maybe we start the entire tour in Florida and you start at Doral or whatever event you want to start here and then move forward. There's a lot of possibilities, but certainly what happened in Kapalua could have been a one-off. And I think there's a lot of players and a lot of officials who hope to be back there next year. But I can imagine it being part of a bigger scenario where the tour is going to be 20 or 25 events. And this is where the cutting starts.
Yeah, and keep in mind the Sony Open contract is coming up as well. I feel very conflicted on this, Rex, because Kapalua is obviously visually stimulating. I think it's really interesting with the terrain and the shots. It's always fun competition. We've seen guys push it 30, 35 under par for winning scores. But conversely, the atmosphere on site is pretty muted. The players make no bones about it that they're rusty. And it's essentially just a working vacation for them. The TV ratings always stink because it's up against NFL, the NFL playoffs. And as you mentioned, it's really expensive for 1 or 2 weeks to host an event on the island of Hawaii. I do think it makes sense if you are the PGA Tour to essentially follow the model that NASCAR has. And that's to make a really huge event first to kick off the season. Doral would make a lot of sense. Phoenix Open would make a lot of sense. Instead of having this soft launch of the PGA Tour season where they're just slowly, methodically churning out 600,000 viewers for a final round Sunday, start with a bang. Make sure you're getting 3 million to tune in for the final round of the Phoenix Open. I think that would make the PGA Tour schedule stronger. But I do think something, even if it's just from a nostalgia standpoint, would be lost if you don't have a Kapalua-type golf course on the PGA Tour schedule.
And it's important to point out, this is a generational conversation. If we were started to have this conversation, let's say 10, maybe even 12 years ago, it probably would have been a lot easier for Brian Rolapp to convince the membership that maybe we need to move on from going to Maui. Because if you look at Tiger Woods and Phil Mickelson at the height of their careers in that era, they didn't go there. A lot of the top players didn't start the season. And it was a lot of different reasons. It was the winds. You didn't particularly want to start the year fighting your swing in the wind. It was the grainy greens. It was everything that people did not like about starting the season out there. It was Jordan Spieth and Justin Thomas and that generation that really changed the thinking. Those guys loved going to Maui. They liked starting their season there. If you didn't make it to Maui, you had a bad year the year before. So it's a little bit different conversation now, but I still think in the broader sense of where the PGA Tour wants to go, this is probably a glimpse into what we'll see a lot more of starting in 2027.
Yeah, I think holistically, I don't like the idea of the PGA Tour ridding itself of some of the most unique venues. I like the idea of them showcasing them. And you can go down the PGA Tour schedule and identify and highlight the best courses, whether it's a Muirfield Village, a Harbor Town, a Colonial, Pebble Beach, a Riviera. Like, I like the idea, if you were sitting in that room with the Future Competitions Committee, of making sure that those tournaments on those golf courses, you give them the best in the deepest fields, you give them the best agronomic conditions, you give them the best windows for TV exposures, and let's cook. And so, you know, the idea of, well, you're not doing that with Kapalua. Like, you don't have the best field because some players, at least internationally, are not going to play, Rory McIlroy among them. You're not going to have the best TV window because it's going to be up against football. You might not have the best agronomic conditions. Certainly this year you didn't, with the drought conditions that were going on Maui. Can you just push it like a month later into mid-February? Well, then it comes with the whole financial decision and the PGA Tour subsidizing the purse as it is right now.
Well, and at the risk of angering our colleague and our friend Mark Rolfing, who is a huge proponent of golf in Maui and has worked really, really hard, and you and I talk all the time about how important he is to golf in Hawaii. I think I brought this up on the roundtable last week when you and I were on Golf Central. The idea, don't give Brian Rolapp and the Future Competitions Committee a reason to take you off the schedule. And when it comes to Maui, you have reasons to take it off the schedule. The first and foremost being, it's not cost effective to pack everything up and send it all the way over to Hawaii for 2 weeks or maybe even 1 week. So you've already given the tour one reason to look beyond what you could possibly be on the future, on a future schedule. The other one would be what you just pointed out. Give me the best time of year to play in Maui. January probably is the best time of year because you have a lot of people in the Northeast that love looking at those vistas and thinking about playing golf in warm conditions. It does not fit probably with what the tour schedule wants to do going forward. So you kind of have two strikes against you right out of the gate.
Yeah, it's one of the most beloved events on golf Twitter. But if you like remove yourself from the echo chamber of golf Twitter, it really has not resonated with a national sporting audience. I think that's why you see six figures in terms of viewership numbers and not necessarily what you'd see during the heart of the PGA Tour season. All right, coming up, some players and tournaments to watch for 2026. You're going to want to clip it because these predictions are sure to be wrong. Okay, Rex, since this is the season preview episode, let's do some punch shots, shall we? Which major are you most jazzed about for 2026?
For production value, this is just to prove that you and I do have meetings before we do this show, and we do confer because you picked the
U.S. We are not going to double up.
Yes, we are not going to double up. You're going to go with the U.S. Open. Spoiler alert on that one. And that one's going to be a good one. I'll leave all the reasons to you. So I kind of defaulted to the Masters, but the more I thought about it, it was a pretty easy default because every year we look forward to the Masters for a lot of different reasons. First and foremost, it's been a minute since we've seen all the top players together. It was the Open Championship, which is months ago. It feels like a lifetime at this point. And the other part of Augusta, and we all know this, it always delivers. I don't know what the secret sauce is year in and year out, but if you look back to last year, I would argue Rory McIlroy walking up the hill, ugly crying, trying to catch his breath, everything that went into that special moment for him was the moment of the year. I think you and I were both kind of on the same page, and it seems to do that year in and year out. The year before,
that's not true. That was the best Masters since 2019. That was the best Masters since 2019 and Tiger. It was like Tiger had sucked the all the excitement and the anticipation of a Masters Sunday. It all was distilled in that 2019, because you look at after that, they'd all been runaways.
Well, we don't get Rory every year. That was a career Grand Slam. That was a lifetime of trying and failure and everything that he was up against at Augusta National. So, no, we don't get that. But I still think the level of anticipation is always the highest going into the Masters because, as I pointed out, it's been months since we were at the Open Championship and you had all the top players together. I think the idea of going back, you and I both experienced this, and we probably spend a little bit too much time in Augusta over that period of time. However, it's the one we look forward to the most. I mean, driving from Florida to the Masters is one of the best drives of the year because of everything that's before you. You talked about it, you prepared for it. I'm sure players are tired of talking about it, but I just think they get it right so often, more often than not.
Around at Palmetto, shout out Brooks. It always is an annual tradition for us. I'm with you. I do worry about a little bit of an emotional letdown this year. I was looking back at my game story from the Masters this year with Rory's win, and I ended it with Rory's quote of, "What are we going to talk about next year?" When he sits down for his press conference. And I do think there's obviously going to be a lot of reflection, but I think one of the storylines of 2025 was also, what's Rory going to do next? How is he going to reset himself? So I think that's going to be an interesting dichotomy as well. I'm with you. It always delivers. There's always plentiful storylines. We're always eager to see which players who have sort of arrived and are building momentum through the spring can carry it into the year's first major as well. As you mentioned, I did go for the U.S. Open as the major I'm most looking forward to in 2026. Here's why. We have not been to Shinnecock since 2018. And remember, that one was a doozy. Phil lost his mind. The USJ lost the golf course. Remember that infamous Zach Johnson press conference? That was the last
time. Billy Horschel press conference.
Last time we had an over par winning score for golf's most difficult test. Remember Tommy Fleetwood nearly stealing the US Open with that Sunday 63. And of course, it was Brooks Koepka, who we just spent about 20 minutes talking about, stamping himself as an absolute beast in the major championships and winning in back-to-back years. Shinnecock is one of the best golf courses in the U.S. And oh yeah, the big storyline that's going to be hovering over the entire championship is Scottie Scheffler, 1 year removed from Rory McIlroy completing the career Grand Slam. Scottie Scheffler, on his 30th birthday, can become the next to complete the final leg of the Slam. How are you not completely jazzed for the Open, Rex?
I am. You stole it. You bigfooted me on that one. You were just quicker to point it out.
I was just quicking the email thread. Love to see
That's
it.
That's right. You were just on top of it more than I. When I got the email first thing in the morning, I had just woke up. And I was, he beat me again. I didn't like that at all. But you're absolutely right. And it's twofold. One, going for the career Grand Slam. And we can make the argument, we're going to point this out, that Jordan Spieth can also win the career Grand Slam next year at the PGA Championship. We don't have nearly as much confidence in his ability to do that as we do with Scottie Scheffler winning at the U.S. Open, because by all accounts, Scottie Scheffler, he didn't have any offseason injuries in the kitchen, thankfully, so we won't have that setback. He's probably going to show up much more motivated somehow than he's ever been in the past. And just the idea, you go to that particular golf course. I know the USGA lost it last time. I know it got ugly specifically.
Ain't gonna happen.
With Phil Mickelson, this is the new and improved USGA. They don't do that. I wouldn't expect it to be anywhere close to the line. And when the USGA doesn't mess up the setup, it's a really, really cool golf course. I would put that in the rotation of sort of those standards. You talk about Pebble Beach, you talk about Pinehurst, and I would put Shinnecock right there as the three best U.S. Open venues. So, yeah, I love that pick.
All right, let's exclude the major championships for this conversation. How about the non-majors? What tournament are you most looking forward to? It's obviously a President's Cup year. I don't think it's going to quite deliver the heroics, the theatrics, or potentially the antagonistic crowd that we had the Ryder Cup, but it certainly is a President's Cup year this year.
Yeah, I think you thought I was going to go with the President's Cup. I had no interest in that whatsoever. Until it becomes competitive, I'm going to go ahead and steer clear.
Maybe this is the year.
We always say that, and I'm sure we're going to have a lot of conversations about it. We still are waiting for it to be the year, but I just don't. You didn't really have enough bass in your voice for me to think that you were convinced on that at all. I actually put I picked two, and the reason I did that is kind of twofold. One, I picked the FedEx St. Jude event, which is the first playoff event, because of where we seem to be going in 2027. And I've made this argument before. I think it was 2 years ago that the FedEx St. Jude was the most important event because that's the one that essentially got you inside the top 50. If you were able to advance out of that first playoff event into the BMW Championship, the second playoff event, that means you were in the top 50. That means you had the golden card. That means you could get into any of the signature events you wanted next season. You were probably in all the majors. So you were able to set not just your schedule, but you were able to set the absolute perfect schedule. If 2027 plays out the way, and we're going to talk about it more, we've talked about it a lot already. If we end up with this condensed scarcity schedule, there's going to be a magic number. I'm not quite sure that's 50. I'm not quite sure that's 100. But players are going to have to at least get into that first playoff event, the FedEx St. Jude. And they're probably going to have to play well enough to get into the second one to at least guarantee that you're going to be a part of this special group, the ones that truly get to go on and play this scarcity schedule that everyone's talked so much about. And the other one's the Players' Championship. And look, we're going to spend so much time leading up to the Players' Championship, which will be the first really big event of the year. We always do the stupid fifth major conversation. I don't think it's the fifth major, but it's by far the fifth best individual event in golf. I think that's the fairest and easiest way to say it. And all you have to do is look at the last six winners. You have Rory, you have Scotty, you have Scotty, you have Cam Smith, you have JT, and you have Rory. When you have a list of winners that is essentially the top of the top of the sport, I think that is testament enough. And last year's playoff was pretty cool. You have to admit, Rory showing up on that cold Monday morning was one of the cool moments of the year.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the majors absolutely showed out last year. So you can pick a number of moments for a non-major, the Players' Championship absolutely stole the show. That is absolutely everything you could want. That arena, those three holes, those conditions, those playoff combatants. I was positively giddy driving to the golf course on that Monday morning, and it delivered and stole the show most certainly. You went cowardly and picked two. Ooh. I'm going to follow the rules and just do one. And I do have a different answer. To me, it's the Tour Championship, because keep in mind, everything is supposed to be on the table for this new and improved PGA Tour. So how about a change and a format change for the season finale? How will Brian Rolapp and company create a logical and cohesive solution for the season-long race? Keep in mind, simplicity is supposed to be one of those three tenets, along with parity as well as scarcity, that is supposed to be driving the PGA Tour. How can you create a simplistic model that doesn't just appeal to us, the hardcore golf audience, but also the casuals, the people who want to tune in and see the best players? How do you define a season-long championship? You and I have talked endlessly on this podcast over the past couple of years, as they are essentially trying to shoehorn two things into one. They're trying to create a really compelling and fun finale while also trying to determine a season-long champion. And so whenever the PGA Tour and this future competitions committee gets through the nitty gritty of here's what our schedule is going to look like, they have to turn their attention to how do you create the best finale for the PGA Tour's Super Bowl. They at least not right now. They don't have any of the biggest events in golf. They at least have the potential to turn the Tour Championship into something bigger than it already is.
I get what you're saying and where you're coming from for this. I would say, and I have a lot of confidence in Brian Rolapp and the direction that he's sending the PGA Tour, and he seems to be the perfect man for the job right now. All that being said, we're three decades into the experiment that is the Tour Championship, that is playoff golf, and they've yet to get it right. So I wouldn't anticipate, I don't think it's fair for Brian Rolapp to get this pie just thrown onto his desk and you're told, here, just fix it. Fix it right now. Fix it so it's perfect. I don't see that happening. And I mean, I'm not saying it can happen. I just don't know how it does, because neither you nor I can come up with what's the perfect scenario. I don't think anyone has ever come up with, okay, this is the perfect fix. Every fix seems to come with its own set of issues. And I wouldn't anticipate that Brian, at least not at this point in his career, can come up with that perfect fix right now.
Yeah, the perfect fix is clearly not 72 holes of stroke play for 30 players. That ain't it. That was the format for 2025.
But sponsors and TV are going to have a say in that as well. So you're trying to, there's so many constituencies here. You're trying to make happy. And I think over the years, the tour has learned, Jay Monahan certainly learned that the best you can possibly do is try to come up with a decent champion that week and make it as simple as possible.
Yeah, I still think the best solution is to separate the two. I may lose that argument, but again, that's for Brian Rolapp and the Future Competitions Committee to decide. I really just wanted to get in one of the three tenets. We never talk about simplicity. I do think that one is important. It shouldn't just appeal to us because we're going to be watching regardless. But it should appeal to casual golf fans and certainly to the mainstream sports audience. The Tour Championship, as it is currently constituted, does not do that. All right, Rex, you and I are writers. We have producer Fred, who does a great job with these lower thirds and the headline writing. And so in your opinion, what is going to be the biggest headline at the end of the year?
Fred, I want you to write this down because at some point in the year, this is going to be the headline. PGA Tour, LIV Golf reach detente. And that's the formal spelling of detente with the accent above the E. I want to point out that this is not going to be a perfect union. It's not going to be a wholesale union, or at least I can't imagine how you get there. As of right now, there's no conversations ongoing. And keep in mind, at this point last year, they were either getting ready or they had had meetings in the White House with the president. I'm talking about the PGA Tour, LIV Golf, and the Public Investment Fund of Saudi Arabia. And nothing came from that. So I know it's a bit of a leap to think that you really haven't even spoken since then. And you're going to get to some point where they're going to come together. Because I think Brian Rolapp, Tiger Woods, the Future Competitions Committee, when they get done coming up with whatever 2027 and beyond is going to look like, I have to believe the next order of business, the next item on the to-do list on Brian's desk is try to figure out a way to bring golf back together. You pointed out earlier in this podcast that the fans were outspoken about this in that study a few years ago. They want to see the best players in the world playing together more often. They have to find a way to make this work. Again, I don't imagine this is a wholesale union. I can imagine you do this almost piecemeal going forward. One of the suggestions you and I brought up earlier in the podcast is maybe Brooks Koepka gets the right to go play TGL, and we see where that goes. And if there's not a lot of pushback and if everything works, maybe next year, starting in 2027, he gets a tour card and you open up this avenue for players to sort of jump back and forth, whatever that might look like. But I think by the end of the year, it will be one of the headlines that Brian Rolapp has to imagine he needs to come up with.
Which is interesting, because if you go back to August in the Tour Championship, he sounded pretty disinterested in any sort of union. And look, you can point to the perceived momentum that the PGA Tour has with ratings and the star winners that they had, the sponsors who keep re-upping. You can look at what LIV Golf is doing and sort of the traction they've been unable to attain, at least here in the U.S. And so you could make the case, does Brian Rolapp and company even need any sort of partnership with LIV?
Maybe not.
And the PIF? I think that's one of the most interesting questions that's going to be asked. If you can reincorporate Brooks Koepka, again, we don't know if that's actually going to happen in 2026. There's really only a handful of other players who, if you're a PGA Tour leadership, would be eager to bring back into the fold. I'm with you. I do think that would be an interesting headline by the end of the year. I'm not actually following the exercise. I should have come up with a headline. If I were to come up with a headline, producer Fred, I would say something like Rolapp gets his wish, reshapes PGA Tour. And I think that will be the headline at the end of the year.
Is there a question mark at the end of your headline? It really sounded like there was.
That was a question mark for producer Fred. I feel emphatic that this will and should be a headline in 2026. I do think, you know, potentially this might be pushed a year. You and I talked at the end of 2025 after talking to some players, as you did at the Hero World Challenge, that it might be a little bit of a rush to get this done for the start of 2027. Maybe 2028 is a more realistic starting point. But I go back, Rex, to the end of 2022 when the PGA Tour unveiled for the first time this signature event series, which was basically a promise that they're going to continue to make a better and better product. But really since that point, so over the past 3.5 years, it's just been Band-Aids. It's just been transition years with the promise of a better tomorrow. They've come up with these swings. They've experimented with smaller fields. They've created, even if not officially, a distinct A tour on the PGA Tour and a distinct B tour on the PGA Tour. And Brian Rolup, ever since he has come in as CEO, has promised wholesale significant changes. And so let's see him finally, because all we have had since 2022 is just these transition years and teasing fans with, yes, things are going to be better. We're going to have a much improved PGA Tour. Now is the time to do it. That's the work of the Future Competition Committee. And I'm hopeful that we're going to get to a point at some point in 2026 that we actually have a model to work off of for 2027 and beyond.
No, I like that. And look, I think Tiger Woods was pretty clear when he spoke about this in December about 2027 is the target date. There's a lot of moving pieces when it comes to this. It's going to take a lot of work. It's going to take a lot of, I'm going to say, negotiating. Because lawyers. You're talking about lawyers, because you're talking about a lot of partners, just not media partners. Every tournament pretty much has a corporate sponsor. Every tournament has some sort of agreement with the golf course. So right now, that's 48 different sponsors, 48 different tournaments. And that just gives you a taste of how complicated that could be.
Okay, Rex, I used a question at the end of my headline. I did not mean to do so because this is actually the question. What is the biggest question mark of 2026? It could be a tournament. It could be sort of a existential question. It could be a player. Where are you going with this?
Rory? See what I did there?
What's Rory going to do?
What's Rory going to do? We've talked about this a lot. The idea that he gets to the top of the mountain last year at Augusta National, wins the career Grand Slam. Where do you go from here? I can imagine it's human nature to sort of sit on top of the mountain and think to yourself, I just want to sit here and relax and take some deep breaths and enjoy this. He didn't really do that. You look at the way he finished the season, certainly what he did at the Ryder Cup, what he did internationally. I mean, he played a lot towards the end of the year, and it seems like he still has plenty to play for. He's not at the end of his career. And you pointed out last week when we were on Golf Central that some of the things are very important to him. However, most of those things aren't happening this year on the PGA yeah. Tour. There is yep. no Olympics. He's talked about wanting to win a gold medal, so that's not this year. That'll be next year. The Open is not at the Old Course. He's pointed out that's one thing he wants to do. The U.S. Open's not at Pebble Beach. That's another thing on his to-do list. And so there's still plenty of things. I think he wants to be the all-time winningest European when it comes to the majors. He still wants to catch Colin Montgomery when it comes to the DP World Tour season ending title. So there is still plenty of motivation, but I think when you look at Rory, and he talked about this going into 2025, the idea that he was going to play less coming into the year. Now, keep in mind, he played 22 events around the world in 2025. Only 15 of those were on the PGA Tour, and he's kind of hinted or insinuated that maybe that trend is going to continue going forward. So I just don't know what the expectation is for Rory, at least here in the United States on the PGA Tour. I think internationally, he's made it pretty clear. He'll go to the Irish Open. He'll go to the Scottish. There are things that seem locked in to his schedule. You don't really have that, I don't think, in the United States. You can sit and call them signature events, and you can say, well, Charlotte's important to him, and I would imagine he will play Charlotte, the Tourist Championship. However, you just don't know when it comes to Rory, because I think he's reached that point where it's not vindictive. He's not trying to be petulant about this, but he's going to go and play where and when he wants to play. There's nothing wrong with that, but it comes with a set of question marks.
Yeah, I like that a lot. I do think there are some carrots, as you mentioned, that are dangling out there, at least in the short term, over the next 2 to 5 years, that should keep him plenty motivated, that should keep him plenty sharp. What I think is going to be really important for him, as we talked about on the roundtable last week, is sort of picking apart the PGA Tour schedule and finding out what's important to him. And at least what he has said in the past of what has supported him is winning on particular venues, courses that don't just mean a lot to him, but I think mean a lot to the history of the game, whether that's a Pebble Beach, whether that's Riviera, whether that's Muirfield Village, doing the National Open thing as he did in 2025 and has continued to do over the course of the past couple years. Those are certain checkpoints and benchmarks throughout the course of the year that he can play up for, try and get ready for, at least sort of have some sort of mind manipulation that gets him in a mode where he's very competitive. Because I think at this point, Rex, he's a living legend, and it'd be easy to go on autopilot and just sort of circle the major championships and just seemingly want to peak for those. That's really difficult to do. Tiger Woods did it better than anyone. But as he is, his body has broken down and he's tried to just do a major only schedule, it's really hard to do. And I don't think Rory McIlroy at the age of 36 wants to get into that mode either. And so if there is something that he can shoot for in February at Pebble Beach and Riviera, if there's something he can shoot for in May with winning at Quail Hollow, or in June with Mirrorfield Village. I think that can keep him going, keep him motivated for the entirety of the season with, again, those carrots that are still dangling, which could make him truly a top five, top 10 player historically. My biggest question mark, though, Rex, is Bryson DeChambeau. Because right now, as we sit here in mid-January, he's got a whole lot of leverage at the moment. Brooks Koepka's left. The stars that Liv does have are either aging or becoming increasingly irrelevant. And Bryson DeChambeau hasn't necessarily translated to a big box office return for Liv, but he is indisputably a top three draw in the sport. And Liv, quite frankly, can't afford to lose him. And Bryson came on a podcast at the end of 2025 and essentially intimated that the negotiations with Liv are not where he wants them to be at the moment. Maybe those will improve. Maybe those will continue to break down. He even intimated that he could potentially just go the YouTube route. He doesn't need to play tournament golf, whether it's on Liv or the PGA Tour. So I think who bends at this point? Is it going to be Bryson, who would potentially be willing to take less to stick with Liv and the franchise that he has made? Or will Liv, sensing that it could be the end of the road if they're unable to retain Bryson's services, offer him as much money as he is looking for? I think we'll know by fall certainly where this is headed, but that is a big question mark as we sit here at the beginning of the year.
It's a big question mark, and it would come with a big paycheck. Let's be honest. If Bryson thinks he's worth something that starts with a B, he's probably going to hold out for that. And I would imagine he's going to move on, because I don't think that the public investment fund has any interest in paying those types of guarantees anymore. If they do not sign Bryson, and I've kind of said this flippantly, and I need to be careful about it, I would imagine that would single, okay, Liv Golf stays are probably numbered. The public investment fund is tired of investing this money. I don't know if that's necessarily true, because the long view here, and speaking with people involved with Liv Golf and beyond, they would tell you that they're looking younger, that if they start picking off these young players, both internationally and in the United States, that's probably a more sustainable future than what they started out with. And I could imagine that model working out for the next 5 or 10 years and seeing where they land. But certainly losing Bryson DeChambeau would be a blow. We just had a long conversation about Brooks Koepka. It's not great for Liv Golf, especially since he opted out of the last year of what was a very lucrative contract. And I'm guessing there was some money given back on that front. But losing Bryson would be a huge blow. And you kind of joked about it, but the other question mark for me will be the President's Cup. Because if it's not competitive again, and you're always going to throw up. But yeah, but there was 15 minutes on Sunday when it was a lot of fun.
There's always a window, Rex. There's always a window.
There's always that Sunday afternoon. Let's call it the witching hour at the President's Cup, where something seems like it could work out. Actually, it was that way at the Ryder Cup as well last year. However, if you can't find a way to make it competitive, and this is kind of like the Tour Championship, I don't think anybody has the perfect answers, but the Tour needs to start coming up with some answers, because you can't continue to have this event be irrelevant, at least from a competitive standpoint, and expect it to be compared in any way to the Ryder Cup. And so I think there are a lot of question marks when it comes to the President's Cup. I think it's time that they start coming up with some answers.
Yeah. Still looking forward to getting up late September to Chi-Town, Chicago, to Medina. Even if it is a blowout, I do enjoy the team competition again. Sure. Even if it's a blowout. How about from a breakout candidate standpoint, Rex? Who is your big star who's going to become a big name?
I'm kind of doing the old hits here, because I said Michael Thorbjørnsen in the fall. I think you and I talked about breakout stars last year. I just had the chance to spend some time with him at the RSM Classic to pretty much finish up the season. And to hear him talk about the injuries that he went through, there was obviously a wrist injury that he had dealt with. There had been some sickness early in 2024 when he started his PGA Tour career. There have been some setbacks for this young man, and it seems to me he's figured out a way to move on. Last year was his first full season on the PGA Tour. I loved the way he finished the year. He made his last 7 cuts. He had 2 top 10 finishes, one of those being at the RSM Classic. But probably the reason I'm rehashing this, other than just being a little lazy, is what he's done over the last few weeks for Boston Commons. Go Boston Commons. On TGL, he has become the breakout star already.
Oh boy.
For TGL. And we have seen his personality, which I don't even think people on tour had seen that. So not only is he a very talented player, that if he can remain healthy and he can avoid those injuries, you have very high expectations of what he can do on the golf course. But we saw it last year with Ben Griffin. If you combine that with a really good personality and someone who wants to interact not just with fans and the media, but on social media and every other aspect of the tour machine, I think that could be huge.
TGL success is now indicative of future performance on the PGA Tour.
From a personality standpoint.
I'll be real quick with this. Rico Hoey had 6 top 10s last season, including 4 in the fall, despite being the worst putter on the PGA Tour. And I don't mean that flippantly, Rex. This was not an exaggeration. He was literally the worst putter on the PGA Tour. He lost 73 strokes to the field on the greens, 180th out of 180. So why am I optimistic? Because if it's not curable, there are at least workarounds. He can find a solution. And on the PGA Tour, he was the second best from tee to green last season. If he just improves marginally on the greens, he will win likely not just a single tournament, but could have a handful of tournaments. Also, like Michael Thorne-Borenson, has a great personality as well. All right, after this short break, some personal notes on the year ahead for us and this podcast. All right, Rex, it's too late for New Year's resolutions, but what are you looking forward to from a personal perspective in 2026?
Personal perspective, and look, everyone's so nice when it comes to everything that we look like. I don't have to see my dermatologist again for another year. And you could probably tell that there was a lot of makeup going on here. The dermatologist did some sort of experiment. It's really gone
just
poorly.
Hack job.
So look at what the dermatologist has done. I want to stay away from her. Dr. White, thanks for everything for at least the next 12 months. But I'm mostly looking forward to what you and I have cooking up. Yeah, as you pointed out, I think the podcast is going to be growing next year. We got a lot of cool things in the hopper. We're going to take the podcast on the road. We're going to get it to you quicker at the big events with the mini pods. And I love the way this is sort of hashing out, the idea that we've taken this for over 10 years now, and it's grown into something I think you and I both have a lot of passion for, and we both enjoy it.
Yeah, I think that's the most important thing. We really want to grow the video audience, the YouTube audience, the social audience. We've got a newsletter idea that we're trying to get across the finish line. A lot of other great things that I think will make this podcast even better in 2026. If you have any ideas, you guys are not shy about it, drop in the comment section. We'll try to incorporate it on the show this year. All right, that is going to do it for this edition of Golf Show Podcast with Rex and Lav. We'll be back next week for a full recap of Sony Open.
Dermatologist.